Our first panel, competing with liquidity with our U.S. neighbors, will allow the panelists representing various industry stakeholders to discuss the current trends and threats in cross-border trading. This panel will be moderated by Deanna Durjevic. Deanna is Senior Vice President, Equity Trading at TMX Group, and is responsible for all aspects of TMX equity trading business. Deanna joined the TMX Group in 2013 after the company acquired Alpha Group, where she served as Chief Trading Officer and Data Officer. Deanna?
Good morning and welcome once again to the TMX Trading Conference. Our first panel today is going to follow this optimistic discussion that we had from Avery. And we will actually go back to the world where there are only two countries in the world and we actually only worry about the U.S. and we leave the other to other panelists. So what we will talk about today is a topic that is increasingly gaining attention in our dealer community, regulators and researchers, about the changing dynamics of the handling of the cross-border flow. Obviously, with the U.S. being the biggest trading partner for Canada, U.S. is an integral part to the health and the vibrancy of our Canadian market. But in the past, we kind of had clear rules. Canadian dealers will send flow to the U.S. dealers for any U.S. names. Equally, U.S. dealers would ask for help from the Canadian dealers to facilitate any trading in Canadian names. And every jurisdiction kind of handled its own needs in interlisting tradings. But it appears that some of those lines are now blurring, and the panel today will explore those options, see if these are good trends, or do we actually have some risks that we need to look at, and if there's anything specific that we want to do to address any risks that we see. So the panel that we have on the right-hand side deals with cross-border trading every day, I guess. And we will organize our discussion around two specific topics. The first part of the discussion will focus on any changes in how Canadian dealers are managing the Canadian flow in interlisted names in terms of the cross-border trading. And the second part, we'll talk about the changes that are happening in terms of how U.S. dealers are managing trading in Canadian symbols and where they used to send them northbound before. There's more and more of that being traded within U.S. today. So we'll try to kind of divide the time both ways because both those topics are important and different, but they both deal with interlisted trading. So I will briefly announce my panel on the side. I think everyone knows everyone on the table, but first to my right is John Riley, Managing Director of RBC Wealth Management. Next to him is James Duncan, Managing Director, International Trading, Canaccord Genuity Group. And next to him is Thomas Kalafatis, Managing Director and Head Execution and Prime Services Equities, CIBC World Markets. And lastly, Dan Echtman, Global Execution Services Director from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Thank you so much for being here today. So I think the first question we want to talk about, is, as I mentioned, is how are dealers changing their management of interlisted flow, both north and southbound of the flow? So I don't know, maybe throw that question, John, and you first.
Sure, I guess. Yeah. I guess it has been a debate over the last several years. Simply, you know, once we got into maker-taker and rebates were being offered in the U.S. and we had the third market dealers, we've consciously looked at our flow going to the U.S. We find that the economics in the Canadian marketplace are good enough today for us not to try to extend a lot of border flow and interlisteds into the U.S. I think the retail investor is better off now than it's ever been before with in terms of the liquidity. We won't talk about OTCs and pinks and bullies, but in just pure the interlisted flow that is of the major markets, you know, we've done an analysis and we've found that we get as good of execution in Canada than sending it and going through the technology and the operational risk that's associated with sending order flow to the U.S. If the economics change, which they could, then we'll look at it again. But today we're quite satisfied with our flow being handled for interlisted for our Canadian retail business in Canada.
I find that amazing. It just seems to me that when we're paying an aggressive fee up here of 0.3 of a penny and have the ability to go down through a U.S. market maker, I apologize for my voice, I'm sort of fighting something, but to go down to a U.S. market maker, get a free execution and perhaps a rebate on the other side, how do the economics work? I mean, obviously you've done the study, but you're doing a lot more shares than we are. This isn't my side of the business, but it just it baffles me.
Well, I mean, if you really look at what's going on in the Canadian marketplace, there's a natural arb for us. Okay, we can post liquidity on the Toronto Stock Exchange, get paid a rebate of 31 mils, and we can actually aggressively take liquidity from other exchanges a lot less, giving us a natural arb. So that, when you actually look at the cost of monitoring, the operational risk, and the technology to send your order flow, plus the foreign exchange, I mean, that takes account a big effect. And the other thing that we think we're obligated to, and I think everybody in Canada should be obligated to, is protecting the Canadian marketplace. I don't want to see us sending a ton of liquidity into the U.S. and basically hollowing out the liquidity that's necessary in Canada. So I think it's important for us to keep it there. And we believe that if you are going to send your unlisted order flow to the U.S., although it's not a rule yet, we do feel obligated to the Trade Act rule that you have to give the proper price improvement. And most U.S. dealers aren't willing to give us that half a cent spread.
Gotcha.
So, again, the effectiveness and the efficiency of keeping it in Canada makes more sense to us.
We'd like to speak to some of the flow that I manage pretty closely is our algo flow, which is not so much trying to keep flow in one market or another, but is simply driven by a best price in both markets. So I think the combination of the technology that allows books to be normalized and to equate market prices in both venues simultaneously and simply provide the best execution to the end client is what's driving some of that flow. So combine that with the fact that investors are more savvy. There's an increasing sophistication in clients knowing that this name can trade in both markets, and our desk will get explicit instructions of be X percent in one market or be X percent in both markets. If we can't provide that to them, then we lose that order. So I think that's a combination in terms of just pure trading and market structure. But I think another factor driving some of that flow is really a corporate, an issuer-type driver that there are Canadian companies that are looking for more exposure in the U.S., more from a corporate banking standpoint, not from necessarily a trading standpoint. So they seek guidance on how can I trade more in the U.S. to raise my profile, make me more aware to investors. And when I think about some of the charts that Avery's shown, that would almost seem to be a good thing just from a Canadian economic standpoint. Those companies may be getting a higher profile, being able to get other issues out or their other corporate banking type needs met. So I think that's a factor that we don't necessarily talk about on the panel with market structure, but it should be known that's out there.
And Dan, I fully agree with you. Institutional business is very, very different from retail business. So I caveat my answers really from just the wealth management retail point of view. I think institutional, when you're looking for size and you're looking for best price, algos going cross-border with proper foreign exchange are absolute necessity for your clients.
Sure.
So obviously no problems here. So Canada's doing well.
Well, caveat being that the prices and the economics have to benefit here. Mm-hmm. If the prices go up dramatically to execute in Canada, obviously competition will force us to go elsewhere.
The one specific one was to pilot a model where there would be no rebates in Canada offered. So how do you think that would impact the management of the interlisted flow?
It comes back to economics. If no rebates, then we're going to reanalyze and we'll probably send more order flows outbound. It'll come down to pure economics.
Well, it's also going to affect the liquidity up here in a dramatic sense. I mean, for my business, I would love it because then I'm competing on an equal playing field with the over-the-counter guys who are trading bullies and pinks in the U.S. They're trading everything flat up. I've got to fight against that plus a 3 mil on top on any aggressive flow. If you take that out of the marketplace, then I've got a fighting chance against these guys. But what's it going to do to our overall liquidity? And that's the scary bit, because until the U.S. starts moving down on any of their maker-taker models, there's no reason for them to move here. It's unfortunate for me, and I'm going to sound like a whiny dinosaur, but it's impossible to fight these guys when they have the ability to not only trade free, give immediate execution on 5,000 shares, 10,000 shares, or whatever, and they can also pay a rebate. And that's why we're losing market share as far as bringing northbound business into Canada. I mean, it's a major factor.
But I haven't seen Justin's piece yet. But I would ask: is it because the underlying investor is buying Canadian stocks and they're from the U.S. and Jim, you probably have a better idea of northbound flow coming up or staying domestic in the U.S. But I would think that this increase in interlisted volume may be because we're actually getting a bigger market in the United States investing in Canada, as opposed to our flow going away. And I don't know, Dan, if you do work to see the difference between whether it is order flow heading southbound or it's just more people investing in Canadian stocks.
Yeah, we don't have the data that shows that.
Like, yeah, I can tell you from our point of view on a daily basis in the retail world, we're probably 50-50 buying U.S. stocks versus Canadian stocks. I'm not talking analysts. I'm talking Apple and Google and Facebook and that. And that's where the investor is putting their stocks. We're not serving the trading community. We're serving the investing community. And it's very, very different than someone trying to make a tenth of a penny or a penny off a stock. We're talking about people that want to make $5 on a trade, not a couple of pennies.
Well, I think the northbound business, to speak to that point, has really suffered over the last 5 years. The amount of people buying and selling Canadian stocks from the U.S. has gone down on a retail, on a smaller size basis. But you just have to look at the S&P and the performance in the last 3 years, and why would you want to buy in Canada when all you got to do is throw a dart on the S&P board, and it's going to go up 30%. So I can understand that in just sort of world terms, but it has diminished. And I believe we're also losing market share to the broker-dealers that make Canadian stocks down there. I think that there's no question that we're starting to lose that for a number of different reasons. Number one is being competitiveness up here, having to pay, I believe, higher fees. But secondly, that the regulators down there, FINRA being the main one, makes it very difficult for U.S. broker-dealers to transact in Canada. They're constantly questioning 100-share prints that go up in the U.S. that are outside the NBBO. And I think I know some of our clients feel very much persecuted by their own regulator for trading in the domestic market. Even though they're getting better prices, better fills, and better liquidity, they're feeling that their own regulator is putting up barriers for them to come here. And that's going to continue on through the rest of this year. There's a change coming in how we compare our trades. It's going from ACT to ORF, which ORF is an over-the-counter trade comparison, which Canadians are not going to be allowed to put up trades on behalf of their U.S. counterparts. So it's going to make it very difficult for a lot of the smaller broker-dealers to deal with this, and some of the bigger guys who aren't participating in the system down there. We could see a substantial amount of order flow lost.
I can certainly validate the FINRA comment, but they are active on many, many fronts.
Well, yeah, but I have a client that said that they were getting inquiries from 2010 on 10,000 individual 100-share prints that were outside the NBBO that FINRA has lined up in stacks of paperwork. 10,000 for 2 months worth of
trading. It's a very active agency right now.
It's absolutely insanity.
I think just before we leave the maker-taker argument, there is flow certainly to keep in mind that are not cost-sensitive, that are really just focused on price and execution quality. That flow is out there. So reducing maker-take, eliminating any maker-taker fees will not affect those flows at all. And I think that, you know, the HFT strategies do evolve. It'd be interesting to see the effect, because if they can take liquidity in Canada without incurring a charge, then you might see more aggressive that side of their strategy executing here, but their resting occurring in the U.S. And of course, the dark pools in the U.S. add another component where, Jimmy, you're kind of mentioning that there's places you can get zero-cost executions in the U.S.
So we talked a little bit about the change that may occur here in Canada with the removal of the maker-taker fees. We're also possibly expecting a trade-out rule in the U.S., which, again, will change the dynamics of what can be done in a dark pool or what the wholesaler can do. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that. If the trade that rule comes to fruition, what would the impact on interlisted trading be? Maybe, Dan, if you want to...
Sure. So the trade-out rule, the proposal, it's similar to the dark liquidity rules that were put in place in Canada, I guess a little over a year ago. But to encourage more executions in lit venues, so there's a mandate that a dark pool execution would have to improve price. So no more executing at the bid or offer in the dark pool. It's very likely that something will happen on that rule based on the SEC comments in various panels and conferences. So we're expecting that rule to go in effect. What's the impact from that? I think you'll see more, the percentage getting done in dark pools will decrease. Not so sure that that's necessarily a good thing, only because when you are going to cross the spread and you're able to get done in a dark pool, you're leaving that display quantity still out there on a book. So if you're trying to track volume, for example, if you're able to get that execution done, not move the price, continue to track volume and go again, that's probably a good thing from a cost execution standpoint or market impact standpoint. But towards the argument of price discovery, maybe this is a good thing. But I think if you're rooting for it, you're probably going to get that wish. It's probably going to happen, is our expectation.
See, I think the trade at rule will force more liquidity into dark. I think that, and I don't know, but I know we've actually started to use more dark pools in Canada simply because of the effective trade at rule, because we are going to get price improvements, so we seek dark liquidity first with an IOC order, and we go through. I think if they go to the trade at rule in the United States, I think it'll actually force more liquidity into the dark pools as opposed to seeing it in a transparent market.
Depends a little on the spread, right? Narrow spread.
Well, it depends
names.
On tick size, right. And it depends on spread. I mean, I'm a contrarian in terms of what goes on in the United States. I was in Washington last week, and listening to some of the senators and that, I don't think anything's going to be done in the U.S. I don't think that the SEC is going to look at some of these rules because they're too afraid of unintended consequences. They're going to take an awful long time to look at this, and I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime that they'll actually get this thing done, only because they cannot move as fast as the regulators in Canada moved against, you know, basically a trade act rule. I just don't think they can do it with the commission and getting that vote across, you know, and then you got elections and you've got all that. So I'm not as
gentleman's bet.
Yeah. So I think we're not going to live with that. And I am afraid of more things going dark. I don't like dark, but it's a necessity that we have to do here because we are obligated to get our clients best execution.
Do you find that you get more sort of front running when you ping the dark pools first?
Interesting question.
Yeah.
What we have done is we've built some analytics to ensure that we don't get front run by pinging dark pools, and we have various types of orders that we use in order to do that. And I think if you're not smart enough, you know, I like to say to people that, first of all, it's irresponsible if you don't understand how the dark pools and the HFTs operate. Any broker-dealer that doesn't understand, that hasn't done their research, we've got a great research team at RBC that does a lot of work in this. We use that. We be very specific in what we do. We've learned how to operate within these environments, and anyone that doesn't is irresponsible,
yeah.
Number one. So you have to look at it. You have to ensure that you're getting best execution, and you have to monitor that monthly. You have to look at every dark pool, every exchange, and ensure you're getting quality execution.
So what is there anything that we should be looking at in Canada? So we talked a lot about the changes that may or may not happen in the U.S. and how the interest from the U.S. shareholders is growing for Canadian names. But as Thomas pointed out, that is kind of leading to an increased share of the pie trading in the U.S. and less here. And maybe we all keep our own investors on each side of the border. But is there something we can be doing in Canada to bring some of that flow to actually execute here as opposed to executing in the States?
Well, I think it comes down to liquidity.
Sorry?
Liquidity. We need market makers. Okay? We do not have a very efficient market making system in Canada compared to what it is in the United States. We do have an RT business. We often get calls from corporate CEOs, CFOs, trying to figure out what's going on with their stock. So if there's an anomaly to ADV, our registered traders may get the call and they'll say, what's going on? And we go, look, it got into the HFT loop. It's just liquidity that's being traded against your stock. It's not someone taking, because, I mean, their biggest concern is takeovers and who's accumulating stock. And if we can actually understand what's going in the market, we can actually bring comfort to the issuers by being an RT. And that's a value that isn't measurable from a dollar and cents point of view to the issuers. So I think Thomas has, you know, if we can improve that, I think then Jim and our firm and other firms can go after northbound flow and try to bring liquidity here, because competing today against the market makers, I mean, I don't know if anyone studied the Knight Trading's annual report. They paid $80 million last year in rebates for payment for flow to U.S. dealers. And not a lot of U.S. dealers get paid for flow, but $80 million they paid. So what does Citadel pay? What did some of the other third market dealers pay? And they're out there. They can only do it with volume. They can only do it with liquidity, and they're making markets out on the street as well as in their internal dark pools. And right now we're competing out there, and they're trying to come into this marketplace, but again, they don't have the incentive.
Dan, any comment?
Yeah, because I think that the comments on retail flow are very pertinent. And, you know, almost just using my firm as one example, the retail flow there is considered extremely valuable. So there's no payment for order flow. And we prioritize price. Again, it sort of comes back, it's always about the execution quality of the trade. Where was it done, at what price, and can you prove to a client looking that day after the fact, being able to provide that transparency to them on where did you execute, why did you execute, what price did you get, what was the book at the time, being able to always explain that to your client not in an ad hoc way, but in a structured way where on any day we're able to provide that to our clients. On every execution going back to them, we're providing that detail. So I think those are some measures. I'm sure there are some firms in Canada doing the same thing, but as far as that reporting that we have to do in terms of 605, 606, and having to show where we're sending flow, who's getting it, what that percentage is, and being clear with our clients how we actually handle their order is something I can't see how you can argue against the value of that transparency.
So let's talk a little bit about the execution of U.S. originated flow in the Canadian names. We know that used to be executed solely by Canadian dealers here in the Canadian markets, and we see trends of more and more of that execution happening on the OTC markets in the U.S. So you touched a little bit on that, James, earlier, but I wonder if you have any other comments in terms of how is that evolving and what do you think the impacts may be?
Yeah, it is evolving, and I think it sort of fits into the Citadels, the Knights, and all those guys. Who are paying for order flow. A lot of the small broker dealers would just as soon send every bit of order flow they get to a single point, send it to Knight and get a rebate on the entire thing. And I think that's really important that the smaller guys don't want to invest in the technology to be able to compare their trades, to do it all themselves. They would just rather send it out to Knight. And they do get great executions. You just look at the numbers these guys put up, and within the domestic markets is great. As far as the Canadian stuff goes, the U.S. broker-dealer only has to satisfy the NBBO on his own market. He isn't obligated to look to Canada to make sure there's better liquidity, there's better prices. And as far as the FINRA thing that we were talking about earlier, the FINRA reports only go out when there's something outside the NBBO. It has nothing to do with them being fair or even current in their markets in Canadian stocks. And that's something that we're always fighting, because we're trying to tell the clients down there, you're going to do better in Canada price-wise, execution speed-wise, and we're going to give you a fully transparent execution as opposed to dealing with guys who are, you know, it's a prop desk, basically. They're just buying them here and selling them there, and that's the old NASDAQ ways, which is great for them, but not really great for the U.S. client. And so that's a sales job for us, but we also need to be working with FINRA and using, you know, our good friends at IROC and working together and saying, you've got to, you know, help us work together to get your clients better fills. Because the way it's being run down there on a prop desk, it's certainly not giving the best of what Canada can do. So that's where we are.
Yeah, and I think the other issue that we see a lot, and because we have a big U.S. broker-dealer business as well, and we have a lot of people that have Canadian names, you know, venture names that are held down there, and they get horrible executions. It's disgusting, their execution. Their problem, and I know, Deanna, you and I have talked about this in the past, and I don't know what the solution is, but their problem is most of those systems are single currency. So when they have to send an order, they have to send it to Canada and have a foreign exchange component, it comes back, and A, their systems can't handle it, and B, they get hooped on the foreign exchange. The OTC has done that with Canadian-listed stocks, depending on which tape you're looking at. And they will, as long as you're registered on another multinational exchange, they'll allow you not to have the filing requirements. I mean, one of the topics that we talked about is the bringing together of regulatory. I mean, how crazy is it that you can trade a Canadian stock that's got a CTO on it up here in Canada, and they have all that liquidity in the U.S., and that's fully open and fully tradable?
Yeah.
Drives us absolutely crazy.
Sinoforest, right?
Yeah, Sinoforest or whatever else. It happens to us. Often, it's not just once in a while that there is a CTO up here because of some reporter, and the reporter issuers goes like, why would I report to BC Securities Commission my financials when I can actually trade freely in a much bigger market? I mean, the U.S. trades 6 billion shares a day compared to our 600 million. So if I have that chance to have that liquidity, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah.
Right? So that's you know, the inconsistency in the rules. So, and I don't think the U.S., as Thomas says, are going to change their rules. I think we have to change our rules. So if it's freely tradable in the U.S. and it's only a disclosure problem with the stock, for us to put on CTOs is only hurting the retail investor. It's really hurting the retail investor.
Just when I think about the retail investor, and it's not the area I work in day in, day out, but when you think about someone having that retail account and, one, their ability to trade outside their country in terms of trying to get northbound flow, there are all these challenges. They've got to be trading with a broker-dealer that can get to Canada, so they have to have access to the market. They need to have the FX capability to do a best price. If they're trading online, they're probably not able to do any of that. They're seeing a quote, hearing a news story, hitting the button. So those are just almost logistical, real world, real life dimensions to who is the retail investor? Like, put a face on the category and think about, well, how would you actually get this person to trade the name up here? So I think certainly FX becomes a difficult part, or they might. I think this is declining, but the need to have everything in a common currency, are there still rules? Again, you guys know the retail market better. Is that really trending away?
I don't know that that's necessarily all true. I mean, in every one of our executions that we send back to our U.S. Broker dealers, we have the inside market at the time with a static FX that comes off of the Toronto Stock Exchange, that we get their feed. And so we have all that information going back to the individual client. Whether it gets to him or not, I don't know, but that goes back to help with OATS and FINRA requirements for all our guys. So, I mean, that's something we've evolved into.
You know, even the news this weekend in terms of what changes are looking for comment, and immediately folks in our firm start going, all right, we're going to have to start up another weekly task force in terms of planning out the changes. They take that long to plan out, prioritize, and execute. So certainly it's a case for looking at, well, how do you scale that? Is it best for every broker-dealer to actually implement very similar type checks or constraints where centralized solutions certainly scale? So thanks for that.
I have one more question, but we have only like 4 minutes left, so I want to make sure that the audience gets an opportunity to ask questions first. So any questions for the panelists? No questions.
Good job.
I think you explained it well. So my final question is, if TMX has one thing to focus on or to advocate for that is supposed to improve the cross-border trading, what should that be? So in our realm, or what we can lobby for, or what should we be?
The only thing that I could suggest that, I mean, obviously I would go for lower maker-taker model, but that's not going to happen. But I mean, the only real substantial thing that I think we as a community can do to try and attract northbound business is to work with our regulators, with IROC and FINRA, to stop barriers being put up. And I you know, not barriers per se, but I mean, they're trying to get back control of how business is done in the United States. And by doing that, they've shut the door on a large amount of order flow that potentially could stay in the U.S. So I would say the TMX needs to help us with lobbying IROC and our good friends at FIN.
I mean, to put a specific one. Oh, sorry. To put a specific one on that is the, how the over-the-counter market is not governed by the same limit up, limit down circuit breakers that the other listed names are. And while it doesn't have to necessarily be the same parameter, same details, but the concept of a price movement on those names should do something. There should be a reaction. So it seems like an obvious one to everyone benefits from. The retail investor benefits, the market benefits. It just becomes another way to prevent a runaway stock making the news.
I'd take a contrarian view on this and not talk about trading specifically or fees, but actually go back to what Kevin talked about this morning, which is I think we need to promote Canadian stocks more to the U.S., to the U.S. retail investors, where there's a demand for the product, which therefore will make them want to trade more in Canada from the U.S., because it's a huge market, and we're missing all of that opportunity. And we have some great Canadian companies. Some are interlisted and some are not. But it would be important for the issuers and the exchange to promote the market. NASDAQ does a great job promoting its market. New York Stock Exchange does a great job in talking about their listings and talking about their companies. And I just don't think that when you go into the deep you know, United States, they don't really understand the Canadian market and how good our market is and how our companies are good. Now, it doesn't help, as Jim reflected, that our performance hasn't been so great in the Canadian marketplace, but certainly I would take that view than trying to systemically try to change either fees or technology or anything like that. I'd actually do from a top-down rather than a bottom-up.
Thank you very much.
There you go.
Finish with some hope.
There you go.